Hey folks, you're listening to Know the Land, broadcasting from the Treaty Territories of the Mississauga of the Credit on 93.3 FM at the University of Guelph. Maybe you're listening through Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever else you listen to your podcasts. It's a show about our connections with the land base, how we interact with the land, how we learn about the land, how we defend the land. My name is Byron, and today's show is kind of special. If you've been tuning in kind of lately, I've been talking a lot about fruit trees that I enjoy, except for last month or last week's, which I was talking about the water hemlock. But I've been talking about Saskatoon berries and mulberries, and actually some holdovers from the mulberry question, the mulberry show, about native and non-native species really got me thinking some more. And just as I record that previous show with Matt Soltis, the urban orchardist, about mulberries, as soon as we did that, the University of Guelph Arboretum released a series of short videos on their Red Mulberry Recovery Program. And one of the researchers involved in that, actually the lead researcher or lead research associate at the University of Guelph's Arboretum, is Sean Fox. And I got to sit down with Sean Fox at the Arboretum and talk about red mulberries, why it's important to be thinking about diversity when it comes to that species, why it's important to prioritize the conservation of that species, what place that species has, what it takes up, what its inherent intrinsic values are, what its eco functions are that maybe the white mulberry cannot fulfill. And it was a great conversation. And I love talking to Sean Fox. He's so smart. He offers a lot of insight, very humble, and has a lot of good stuff to say, and he's done his work. So here's the interview with Sean Fox. Sean, can you tell me more about your work at the Arboretum and your work in sort of the general field of conservation?
Sure, yes. So I've been working at the Arboretum for a little over 20 years, various roles, curatorial and management, and I'm currently in role of senior research associate. So working on a few of the conservation programs, but I guess more specifically working on a broader rosaceae collection development, which is a huge group of plants with a lot of native species. So it's really just a chance to get a lot of those more obscure native species into a space where people can observe them and learn them and compare them and all that kind of thing. So
when I think about the rosaceae family and the native species, I think of a lot of edibles. Are you
yes.
going to be focusing or like thinking about a lot of edibles in that collection?
Yeah, to an extent. I mean, it's such a huge group of plants. It's almost overwhelming. I mean, the Arboretum is a little over 400 acres, and if you actually broke out all of the groups, so, you know, roses, apples, pears, plums, apricots, service berries, hawthorns, spireas, potentillas, it's huge. If you break those all out to cultivars, so both ornamental and fruit production, it's just like, yeah, you could fill the whole city with them.
Yeah.
So probably the biggest challenge is to be concise and try to show a lot of the species diversity. So we've really been ensuring that a lot of the native species are represented first and foremost. And that's sort of, you know, from an education standpoint, but also a small scale conservation standpoint, that we've actually got some from wild provenances here. And then from there, showing a little bit of what you'd expect to see of the relatives from other parts of the world. So a chance to kind of compare that global diversity. And then pulling from that, you get some of that species diversity where, you know, both by the human hand, but sometimes naturally you have these, you know, bigger, tastier fruits or more flashy flowers or different fall color, things like that. So it's going to touch a little bit upon all those things, but you know, just using apples as an example, and even just using heritage apples as an example, it'd be such a huge collection that we don't really have the capacity to or space to maintain, but we're at least going to give people a taste of that and then really bring them back to the wild relatives. So,
yeah.
So where they all came from and have people see that.
That'd be cool. I've never seen a native crab apple.
Oh, cool. Well, we got some coming. They're in pots.
Right.
So Malus coronaria, so that's the native Ontario crab apple, but also Malus sieversii, which is thought to be the mother species of all edible cultivated apples, and that's from Kazakhstan.
Wow.
So that's another cool one to kind of show. And of course, you know, having a few of the common typical cultivars there for comparison, but
yeah.
But yeah, just a chance to see. Yeah, you always think of all these things that we eat, and then and then obviously we've selected things a lot over the years, but then how different some of those wild crop relatives can actually be. But also when you see them, like, oh, okay, I can see how that can be, came from that, you know. So
I interviewed Brian Husband a few years ago, and it's got changed my view on apples. And it's just like like the enormous variety, the enormous complexity, and just like the wild, what is it, heterozygous or something like that? So that they, as they breed, they will come up with different qualities and traits of the two parents, similar to humans. And that's so cool, you know? And so like the possibilities of an apple are endless.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that's, you know, the Rosaceae family as a whole, there's such complexity because some of them are so promiscuous with each other. So both species, and then, you know, you get these crazy hybrid complexes. But sometimes interspecies as well. So, I mean, the fact that things exist like Sorbo aronias, so you can actually cross mountain ash with chokeberries. Wow. Like the fact that the rose family is you know, related enough to each other, even when plants are so divergently different looking, that they can sometimes cross is you know, sometimes a sterile fruit or sterile seed that comes with it. But it's a fascinating group, and it's huge. It's like a lifelong thing, right?
Yeah. That would be my new thing to keep an eye out for. I don't think I've ever seen that either.
Sorbo
aronias.
Yes.
Can you tell me about the Red Mulberry Recovery Project?
Yes.
Or program?
Sure. Yeah. So the Red Mulberry Recovery Program was started here a number of years ago, really, I guess, rather spontaneously initially, due to several partners in the region having red mulberries in their watersheds. So Conservation Halton, Hamilton Region Conservation, and then partners at Point Pelee National Park, and some friends on Pelee Island, our former creator, John Ambrose. And they were looking at working with red mulberry as part of the provincial species at risk stewardship funding projects. And really the first thing was, okay, this species is rare here in Ontario, but you know, we'll get into this detail a little bit, but there's also white mulberries and then hybrids, and we're not sure about the hybrids because sometimes they can look very similar, so how do we know? And then the question came up, is there assistance that we could have with determining which ones are pure through DNA analysis? And then if they are pure, is there ways that we can reproduce some of these plants so that if the ones that we have are lost, that we have some of those important, you know, genetics still backed up somewhere? So it kind of started from there, and then over the years it's expanded to kind of cover a few more partners. But really the purpose for the Arboretum here has been to really, it's a complex issue. Southern Ontario is very fragmented as far as the forests, and the red mulberries themselves are, you know, not just competing with white mulberry as far as hybrids being created from them, but also just human encroachment and invasive species and everything else. And even in some populations like East Sister Island and Middle Island and Lake Erie, it's cormorants that are completely, you know, the nests are so broad that these like little red mulberries that are surviving are just covered and barely, you know, photosynthesizing. So so really the goal was just to ensure that we can back some up so that we can enable ourselves to ask some of those future questions about what can we do? Like, is it even possible to save the species? Is it important to save the species? But if you wait too long, you're not going to have that opportunity to preserve those really critical genetics that have been, you know, essentially marching north into Southern Ontario for the last 12,000 years since the last glaciers receded, and potentially really important from a climate change adaptation standpoint. But they're under a lot more stress than even some of the core populations nation is in the U.S. So that, again, maybe ties into some other species as well in Southern Ontario, but just ensuring that we can actually say, okay, this is a red mulberry. There's one over here. There's one over here. These are our partners. They're helping us. Let's ensure that we know they're red, and let's find a way to back them up so that we can actually then start thinking about what the next step is.
So are y'all collecting seed, or are you trying to do like vegetative reproduction grafts, or how are you propagating them?
It's been a bit of everything. So the first partnership we actually did was back in 2011, and that was with Royal Botanical Gardens, and they actually have the largest population in Canada in their wild lands. So and again, very fragmented, so surrounded by Hamilton, Burlington, and really the thought was, okay, the trees that we have here are you know, they're facing multiple stresses. We do know there's hybrids in here as well. There's lots of white mulberries planted around. So growing some was a challenge, because obviously if you're just collecting fruit from even what you know is a pure red mulberry, there's a good chance that you're getting hybrid in there, right?
Yeah.
So from the standpoint of at least wanting to ensure that those North American genetics that exist, we know what we're working with here. We did controlled pollination with those trees initially. So that was determining which ones were pure red mulberries and then finding the males, finding the females. We actually harvested the male flowers and put the flowers in basically just big aquariums to capture the pollen, and then bagged the female trees and then introduced the pollen. Mm. So we were able to grow a number of seedlings initially from those plants that were at least, you know, controlled in that sense. And that was it was good to be able to do that, to say, okay, we've got red mulberry seedlings where it's you know, collecting from the fruit from pure red mulberry, which we have tried before and then tested, you still get some hybrids coming up from that, right? So that was just a means, again, to say, okay, we're going to slap a label on this and call it North American red mulberry, so let's make sure we have what red mulberry would have been here, like that, those origins. Since that time, we've been playing around a little bit more with cuttings and rooting. And the main reason being is that the controlled pollination is as interesting a project as it is. It's difficult for a lot of reasons, especially when you're scrambling up the escarpments with these little orchard ladders and trying to, you know, get to the lowest branch to, like, you know, dust a flower with pollen. So it was really a means to try to bring those same plants back to a space where they can get a little bit more love and care initially. And if that tree is lost in the wild, we at least still have this one here. The rooting has been a kind of an experiment, because it's something that they're a challenging plant to root. So some things you can kind of stick in, they just take off. Others you can stick in, and, you know, a little bit of effort, you can coax some roots out of them. With these ones, the root production is the success rate is producing roots is moderately high, but it's a real challenge to have the shoots withstand the long period it takes for them to root. So softwood cuttings in the summer, the roots take a fair amount of time to form, and by that point, if you actually lose buds on the top, basically those little rooted plugs will sit there and then nothing happens the next spring. So overwintering and getting them through dormancy has been a bit of a challenge, but we're making some progress on that. And I mean, currently there are actually a fair amount of little rooted ones coming along, so if they get through the next month, you're kind of like, okay, great.
Fair amount would be that'd be like 50, 200.
Yeah. So I think in an average year with partners sending us cuttings. So, you know, obviously being really careful with the trees to not harvest too much. So sometimes it's 5 to 10 little shoots.
Yeah.
And depending on where they're coming from, you know, some of the places have 4 trees.
Okay.
And others have, you know, 100, like RBG, for example.
Yeah.
100 plus. So. So kind of working with what you have, and obviously the material in the wild, if we're doing kind of horticultural, you know, shoot cutting propagation like you would in a commercial nursery, you've got your, you know, your perfect plant growing, you've got all your stems are perfect. In the wild, you've got these scraggly plants sometimes reaching for light, and not a lot of the material is really suitable for that. So really, again, the goal was to at least do our best to get some here that then you can reselect from in the future.
Yeah.
And again, without really setting up a plan to say, hey, we're going to repopulate the world with red mulberry, because that's probably not practical and not going to work that way. But at least the potential exists, if these plants are here, that maybe it's easier to do controlled pollination and give people pure seedlings or to root them from material that you can just kind of walk out back, get it at the right time of year, and not have to, you know, drive 3 hours in coolers with it. So it's been that kind of multi-year process to get it to that point.
Yes. I've just been a fan since I've heard of air layering, or like marcotting. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Has that been tried at all?
We haven't tried that yet. We've been talking about a little bit more about trying with some grafting, which we have quite a bit of experience with our Elm Recovery project. And the key with grafting is it's sort of different timeline schedules, but then what we graft it onto. And I think the initial thought was we might have to graft it onto like mulberry hybrids or white mulberries, depending on how they take. But with the goal of that is that once those grafted plants take, we can then select cuttings from those as well, or regraft them. So with the air layering, we haven't tried that yet, but I think that opens up a lot of opportunity in the same way. If we can actually get some plants here first, then we can actually set up those air layering processes,
that works.
Which is really tricky because most of the wild plants are in conservation areas, provincial parks, either a little bit trickier to access or at least get out to kind of check moisture on a regular basis. But then also you're trying not to bring too much attention to them at the same time. So depending on, you know, the rules at each particular place. But I mean, some of those things that we have tried on other species, it's, you sometimes need all the tools in the box, right? Because there's a few plants that you can just do anything with, but there's others that really, you have to really pick and choose what's most effective. So,
are the Morris rubra threatened continent-wide, or is it mostly north of the political border between Canada and the state?
Yeah, it's always the thing, right? Because plants don't deserve those political borders as far as what's you know, at a state or provincial level, rare or threatened. But I think, you know, the core of the population in eastern North America is south of us here. And from what we understand, quite secure, certainly more secure. In Ontario, they're at the northern extremity of their range and also in one of the most heavily developed populated parts of North America. So as I said, some of their challenges are certainly just with fragmentation and then, you know, that influx of pollen from white mulberries, which are much more adaptable to those urban conditions, and they're kind of flooding, thriving, flooding, and those I guess wild populations that are still somewhat urban in some ways too. Those Hamilton, Halton, Niagara populations, for example. So that's definitely a threat that wouldn't be quite the same throughout kind of broad swaths of the Appalachians where you've got some bigger contiguous cores. But I think the other thing that we're not quite sure of yet is mulberries are getting more attention in Ontario and Canada because they are endangered. So we have kind of these priorities for funding or people looking at things and saying, oh, it's endangered, it's not doing well. Oh, and also we just learned that there's actually hybrids out there, right? And we're learning about that with other things like butternuts. You know, 30 years ago, we didn't realize how prevalent hybrids were. And actually wild crab apples now through Brian Husband's work, actually seeing that a lot of the wild ones out there are actually hybrids with a lot of the non-native kind of cultivated ornamental ones as well. So I think with the further south, the question would then be, are the hybrids much more common down there in some areas than we actually realize, but people aren't looking at them because it's not a priority species, right? So, and that's, you know, it's an interesting thought, because I think sometimes with hybrids, it's almost like a family reunion, right? You're bringing plants from other parts of the world that, you know, species that diverged a long time ago kind of coming back together. Maybe that's a good thing, maybe it's not. There's a lot of debates about those things. I think certainly even the thought of, if we lost all the red mulberries, maybe it would be good to have some hybrids, because then you've got some of the North American kind of origin in there, same with butternuts and things like that. And you know, to be honest, there could come a point where that's what you have to work with, right? Mm-hmm. And I think the goal here is, at least, you know, we have these red mulberries here, so let's make sure we're holding on to what we can for now. And it's not really meant to be a selection process. It's more so meant to be kind of an archive so that we don't lose a wild species crop that could be serving a really important ecological role that the hybrids or the whites don't. And that's the thing, that we there's so much we don't know, right?
Yeah. So what do you know about that specialization of the red mulberry in contrast to the white? Is there certain ecological functions or relationships that the red mulberry has that the white can't fulfill?
Yeah, well, I think what we often see with things, especially things that produce kind of tasty, edible things, and we see the birds going nuts for them. And that's certainly something we can say. Well, I mean, as much as we love to eat white mulberries, you know, the ones you pass by. And also, I guess I even back me up a little bit further. I mean, as far as white mulberries being introduced into North America, because we like the fruit, but also for the silk industry as well, to test that out. The birds will eat those white mulberries, and they will spread the seeds, and that's why they're thriving, and it's great. You know, the birds are good, but part of that equation is still missing, because the birds are eating the berries. But what we know with a lot of native species is that when the birds are raising their young on insects, most native species support far more insects at the larva stage. So as good as the white mulberries are doing at producing tasty fruit late in the season, they're doing a far worse job earlier in the season with supporting insects. And I can't say I'm an expert on the entomology and the host relationship of everything that would be using red mulberry versus white mulberry. But I think in most cases you can look at white mulberry and see those nice, rich, thick, glossy green leaves, super healthy, robust, huge fruit crops, and then, you know, red mulberry kind of struggling probably with some hosts that would have been you know, tolerable, you know, hosting insects, which they've been doing for thousands of years, but then having all these other pressures put upon them,
yeah. Right?
And I don't know, it's interesting, because I think as someone who, you know, loves thinking about those relationships and obviously the importance of trees and native plants, and I know, you know, someone like Douglas Tallamy's book, yeah. who people really know that list really well about, you know, oaks being at the top, and
yeah.
And I think, you know, there's a lot of oak diversity across North America, a lot of species, they support a lot of species in turn. But then, you know, at the very bottom of the list, there's things like a sweet fern, which maybe supports one cool moth, right? Mm-hmm. And then you think that's still really important for that reason, right?
Yeah.
And again, I don't know enough about all the things that maybe would be hosted on a red mulberry, whether it's insects or, you know, fungal, bacterial, lichens, whatever it may be. But theoretically, they would be at a slight competitive disadvantage compared to non-native counterparts, which we do see with a lot of invasive species.
Yeah.
When they really take off, it's because they just don't have those same pressures on them.
Yeah.
Right? So
that'd be a good project maybe for a student at the university.
Yes.
Looking into.
Absolutely. Yes. Yeah. Good field work opportunity.
Yeah. Yeah, that'd be great.
Yeah.
Because that's something a big question is like that, and like, what is it about the fitness of the white mulberry pollen that can spread better or be more dispersed? Is that
yeah.
the thing that's going on, or is it just like, why is the white mulberry more successful seemingly so far? Is it
yeah.
the urbanization? Is it
yeah, I mean, it certainly could be just they've been introduced to an environment where they really thrive first and foremost, whereas red mulberry has always been a component with all of its, you know, forest associates
yeah.
for all these years, and they kind of strike a balance. I would say upon just general observation, the amount of flowering and fruiting you see on white mulberries can be really,
okay.
like almost, there's some years you look at the branch and think like, you barely
yeah.
see a leaf on there, so much fruit. And red mulberries, you know, wild individuals, you kind of see, you know, flowers here and there. I'd maybe say it's somewhat similar to Nori maple versus sugar maple.
Okay.
Nori maple has this annual heavy crop, and sugar maple yeah. has a heavy crop every 3 to 5 years.
Yeah.
And then there's over time, you know, that slight competitive disadvantage where after a century,
yeah.
you've had every year a Nori maple putting out seedlings in that, you know, understory versus a sugar maple. And it could be kind of similar where we're seeing just there's really good floral production and, you know, pollen thrown out every single year with white mulberry. And especially if you've got just a handful of red mulberries in a little forest fragment, and it's kind of surrounded by, you know, naturalized white mulberries, but also urban ones that have been planted, it's just they're simply just being flooded by so much pollen,
yeah.
right? And I think, you know, tying it back to kind of native species, oaks are really fascinating because most of the native species, they hybridize, but you can expect to find hybrids more often when you've got, for example, a handful of pin oaks surrounded by hundreds of red oaks. And then you can almost expect, if you walk around enough, to find a hybrid between those two, because the red oaks are, there's so much pollen out there that the chances of those pins getting,
yeah.
you know, getting some of it is more likely to find those hybrids. So that's what we're seeing with the red mulberries. But then also even the hybrids, though, think, okay, the hybrids are 50-50, but each generation it kind of keeps skewing further and further towards
yeah.
99% white mulberry. So ultimately you end up seeing kind of the extinction of at least the local populations that have been here for thousands of years. And, you know, I always love to pull yourself back from it in our kind of human experience and think of nature more broadly, you know, without us here over millennia, and think like nature finds a way.
Yeah.
And even sometimes being impressed with that buckthorn in the parking lot, thinking, okay, you get a bad rap, but, you know, good for you for being as tough as you are. So
yeah.
if we screw things up too much, at least something will be alive, right? But at the same time, I think the rate at which we disrupt things right now with our human activities can be really, really accelerated.
Yeah.
And obviously we can't fix everything either, but I think with the red mulberries, it's like, okay, we don't even know what fixing it means, but let's just make sure we have the opportunity to figure those things out over time.
Yeah.
So,
and in light of that human acceleration, and I think this ties back to the question I want to ask you, because you wrote an article, Picking Up the Pawpaws, The Rare Woody Plants of Ontario Program at the University of Guelph Arboretum.
Mm-hmm.
And you wrote, by collecting more provenances, am I saying that right?
Yeah. Okay.
By collecting more provenances, including those at the extremes of a species range, we can come closer to fully conserving and representing the genetic diversity of the species.
Yeah.
Why is it important to collect and conserve genetics at the extremes of the ranges?
Well, I think anything at an extremer range, that could be the south, that could be the north, that could be higher elevations or entering different habitats, you're putting, I guess there's certain selection pressures with that species that you know, if you have 1,000 seedlings come out and one of them just happens to be more drought tolerant, then that's the one that survives and can actually, you know, move forward, especially with plants that are getting squeezed from the south or from lower elevations. And I think, you know, historically a lot of conservation work has been, you know, I'm thinking global plant conservation, where you say, okay, you know what, this is a species that's important, so we're, you know, plop in the middle, we've got some seeds, they're sent out to every botanic garden in the world,
yeah,
we're all good, but you're like barely, you know, scraping the surface about genetic diversity, right?
Yeah.
And I think, you know, tying back to my mentor, Henry Koch, with work he was doing in the early 80s here, with that Rare Woody Plants of Ontario project that John Ambrose started, but also doing some cold hardiness trials with things. And I mean, it kind of comes from even the nursery standpoint, like people wanting to plant pawpaws or red buds, but I can't grow them in Ottawa. And then you find out, well, someone is. How's that working out? So with, you know, even building a collection here at the Arboretum and trying to push the limits on some things, you know, we found red buds, for example, from different populations. You can grow a block out of several hundred of them, and actually, you know, there's a difference in cold hardiness with different populations, which makes sense because they grow in Texas and they grow in Michigan, right? So, so I think with Ontario, though, we've got all these endangered species, and I'm using air quotes here in the sense that they're endangered to us, Ontario. But I know people in the U.S. be like, oh, they're all over the place. Like, what's the big deal? But those are those plants that are, you know, have just in the last few centuries, in some cases, a little bit longer for others, depending on how quick the seed is spread and things like that, but have been moving north. And they've been moving north for the past 10,000-12,000 years. And now they've hit this massive roadblock of urbanization and farms and agriculture and everything else. So it's really, really hard for things to move right now. And for things that maybe need to continue to move further north as part of that natural progression, those ones that are from those Ontario sources that maybe are more cold hardy, moving further north, are going to have more importance than, you know, being able to collect that same seed from South Carolina and say, it's a red bud, it's a pawpaw. Like, who cares? They're all the same, right? And we're learning they are different. I mean, that's the amazing thing, because every plant from a seed is different, just like all of us. They might look identical to us, but there's little traits that sometimes are obvious and others that we have no idea. And that's the thing, like, you know, species resilience and you know, ecological resilience is based upon that diversity, because you don't even know what the next issue is. And having as many pieces of the puzzle in place means that, you know, you've got that buffering capacity for nature to be resilient. So
the redundancy allows for, the redundancy can be about diversity, because it's never truly redundant, right? Like, the more individuals from the more diverse seed banks can provide more possibility for different traits.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. You know, and we've actually experienced a little bit with the Elm Project, and that was, again, Henry Koch's thought was to, you know, work with some trees that have been surviving Dutch elm disease.
Yeah.
And I think the motive that often people have is like, let's find that perfect tree that survived Dutch elm disease. It's got a nice shape and we'll make a million of them. And then, of course, well, they're all clones and they're all equally susceptible to whatever comes along next, right? So what's been really interesting, though, with working with so many trees, so Henry's goal was to work with as many survivors across Ontario as possible, to have as much genetic diversity as possible. It doesn't matter what shape they are or whatever else. It's like, there's things that those trees might possess that we don't realize are even important yet. And I think observing some of those trees over the years, I've seen that our goal was to bring them here and archive some of those parent trees, and then obviously test their tolerance to Dutch elm disease. But through that, even seeing all these survivors that have made it through those trials, there's years where you get a few replicates of the same mother tree, and they're all completely defoliated by elm leaf beetle, but all the other ones are fine. But they all went to that one for some reason, right? Other ones, I remember we had a really droughty year. There's multiple replicates of the same mother tree that just, like, one tree in particular just was so wilted. All the other ones were fine, right? And then you think about how even a species like elm, where you can find them growing in wet situations beside lakes, others that are a little bit more upland, and how those little subtle niches that could be possessed in each little seedling coming out, how important they are to spread to the next spot, right? So not just putting all your eggs in one basket, right? So,
and you think of how that works over time to create, like, differentiation between species.
Exactly,
you
know, like, yeah.
the process of glaciation, how it diverged species based on which side of the continent you're on and how far the glacier's gone.
Yeah, and they find their way to survive, and then they move forward, right? It's pretty fascinating. It's on such a huge level, it's humbling, right?
Yeah. I'm going to ask you a hard question, or at least it's a hard question. It's a question I've been encountering a lot.
Sure.
I've been reading some books like Invasive Plant Medicine. I can't remember who wrote that one, or Dow Ryan's The War on Invasive Plants. And even Peter Deltredici's Wild Urban Plants of the Northeast.
Yeah.
I love that book.
Yeah, it's a neat book.
And the introduction. He asked this question in a different way, but are conventional conversations around conservation kind of is xenophobic in a way that they fear anything from outside coming in? Or do they sort of embody what some folks might call like maybe a decolonial lens of helping to assist and hold native species and how do I phrase it here? Retain ancestral and cultural land-based relations with those native species. How do you see that playing out? Is it kind of xenophobic? Are we scared of what's not from here? Or is it more like we actually want to retain the ancestral?
I think it's a great question. I guess it even ties back to some things we've already been talking about as far as nature is very dynamic. It's not static, right? So I think we've been talking about things migrating since the ice sheet last receded, right? And I think there's still a point in time, even within the province, we will look at, you know, watersheds or counties and say, you know, back in 1871, we did a biological inventory, and this is what grew here. So this is what's appropriate.
Yeah.
And we can't plant this one species the next
county
over, even if it's native and rare or whatever else. And I mean, sometimes that's for good reason, because we don't want to be irresponsible and just, you know, fill Northern Algonquin Park with cucumber trees or something, right? Yeah. But then also we get so stuck on this like point of like, this is exactly how it's supposed to be, that we forget that nature's changing every second all the time, right? Now, again, I think probably the bigger issue now is certainly how much we impact things on such a huge level. And that's almost exponentially every year of human existence now is just like, we're impacting things so heavily that our choices obviously can really, it's a much more impactful situation when we make decisions or when we make changes and things. I think now a lot of our urban areas are very novel ecosystems in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
So we can't just say, hey, this is what this was like here, because it's not like that anymore. The topsoil is gone. The microbes are changed if there, or there's asphalt, there's all these things. So I think we do have to have very, you know, humble and thoughtful discussions on how, you know, native plants, how a restoration project looks in a situation that is not the same as it was for the past few centuries because things are different. We're not going to be able to eradicate all non-native species in North America, even if we wanted to, even if that was practical and a good idea. So I think there are cases where we accept that, you know, there's some things that are here to stay.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean that maybe we don't try our best to prevent some genies from getting out of the bottle, like recently invasive things that are causing crazy amounts of ecological destruction. But it's there's a lot of nuance to that, I think, as far as I'm not sure if I'm completely answering your question there, but I think it's striving for some level of, I guess, perfection is challenging, because I don't think that exists as far as how that goes. And I think with red mulberries, tying back to that thought about, you know, we'd be saying white mulberries are bad, hybrids are bad, so we want to have pure red mulberry genetics and select from those only. And I don't think that's really the motive of the project here. The project is really just to preserve something before it's gone. But then certainly that means anything else that we do moving forward with red mulberries, or any other species for that matter, has to be a really thoughtful discussion about, you know, how are things now versus how they were, and what can we do to make positive impacts?
Yeah,
because we have a means to do that at such a significantly larger scale than most other biological organisms. I don't know. I guess ants can do quite a bit underground. I'm trying to think of, you know, but we, you know, things that we do now, especially on a on a joint scale. You know, I'm saying if we have ideas that we kind of spread across the world, say this is the right thing to do, that impact is really significant. So it's really important to have these very discussions for that reason. Yeah. So I don't know if you want to tie that back in, or if I answered your question there. But
I think that's it, though. I think, like you say, it's nuance, and then it's about conserving something before it's lost.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that I always answer that question that it is nuanced, and it needs to be considered deeply and thoughtfully, hopefully with a good amount of time, but at the same time recognizing that some things are spreading quickly.
And absolutely, yeah.
We had this discussion with one of my adult programs recently about rusty crayfish coming into the Aramosa, pushing out native crayfish, and being a lot more aggressive in how they move, and a lot more populous. I think the females have more young than some of the native species. And it's a hard question. It's a hard question. How do we just go around killing individuals hoping that'll work? Observe for a long time? I've heard of like the University of Illinois doing studies on garlic mustard and how the allelopathy goes down after 30, 40 years.
Okay, yeah.
But it takes 30, 40 years to do that. And like how many other species, when you
lose
trees,
the meantime, yeah.
You know, trees, maybe it takes 100 years to learn
what's
happening because they move a bit slower. But
yeah,
it's tough, and it takes a lot of observation, but do we have time for observation?
Well, that's the thing, right? And I would say the same thing. I think garlic mustard, you know, some large patches I've been managing for the last few years, and you know, this year especially, just seeing some of the native species seed recruitment coming back in, it's really encouraging. And you think, okay, well, you know, had I not been managing that patch, maybe it would be 30 years, or maybe some of the species that would be spreading seed would be gone before then. And I think it's, you know, with invasive species, I guess tying back to another point we were discussing earlier, I always feel hopeful because I know nature is really resilient.
Yeah.
And 1,000 years from now, they'll all balance themselves out. Buckthorns will have some sort of fungus on them, and garlic mustard eventually will be eaten by something. Yeah. And it'll all work itself out. It's going to be very different. But really, the biggest impact is on ourselves, because we are so dependent on things being a certain way. And invasive species impact, obviously, to anything, our food production systems or forestry or whatever. And also just our, you know, we're going to lose species in the meantime. We already are, obviously, because it's not just that individual plant that's getting choked out by the garlic mustard or outcompeted by the rusty crayfish in the river. But obviously all the things that depend on it, right?
Yeah.
And then you have that kind of crashing of the local food chain, and then it impacts, you know, you have huge pest infestations on your crop you're growing or something, right?
Yeah.
So that impact, I think we see more immediately. You know, nature will be okay in the long run, but that's still also kind of a cop out too. It's also like, well, you know what, it'll be okay. So let's let all these species go extinct, right?
Yeah.
So I think there are things that we can do in a really positive way to make positive positive impacts, while also realizing that that nature still is dynamic. Like there's going to be some things that are going to be different than they were 200 years ago, and that's to be expected for a lot of reasons. But I think making having thoughtful discussions on these things, and obviously realizing that the choices that we make and the actions we take every day have a really significant impact now. And maybe they didn't the same way, you know, 50,000 years ago, when there was not as many of us on the planet, right? But they really do now. So.
I like that. I appreciate the nuance. I appreciate the uncertainty, you know, because that's how I feel. But doing the best we can with whatever we've got.
Mm-hmm.
One thing I really like about the Red Mulberry Recovery Program is that y'all have made these videos that I've seen on Instagram that teach people about the program. I think the folks featured in the videos, there's you, there's Sarah.
Yeah.
Sarah's last name?
Sarah Farkason. Yeah.
And you're talking about how, and we talked about this at the earliest part of this interview as well, that one of the main issues, not only is it white mulberry coming in that's affecting the red mulberry, but it's also got habitat loss.
Mm-hmm.
And what do we do as conservationists? What do you do as a conservationist in a position of working with the Arboretum?
Mm-hmm.
How do you approach habitat loss? How do you work with landowners, or do you work with landowners? How do you convince folks to say, hey, quit cutting down the forest, plant more?
Sure.
How do we work to challenge that larger cultural and political context which enable and encourage the development?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, being connected to the university, I mean, a big part of our role is outreach and education, right? So I think, you know, very basis, tying into the mulberries, for example, I think of the fact that most people don't even know that white mulberries are as prolific as they are, right? It's a mulberry. And I think some of that's come up, I think, with some of our opportunities to kind of partner with people working on new books and saying, you know, if a book says Trees of Ontario and they're flipping it open and they see red mulberry, they don't see much mention of white mulberry. It's not really a tree. They're assuming red mulberry is everywhere most of the time. You know, we're always getting calls and emails from people saying, I've got this amazing red mulberry. And it's like, oh, it's probably a white. So that's just an education thing. You know, a simple thing like a white mulberry cultivars that are pendulous, for example, is weeping mulberries you see on front lawns.
Yeah.
And maybe if you live beside a conservation area that's hosting red mulberries, you know, those are the choices that aren't the best ones to make, right? If you're planting that weeping mulberry much further north in Ontario where there's no red mulberry populations, then, you know, maybe that's not, and that's where the nuance comes in, right?
Yeah.
Like, I think of a section in my backyard that's just been covered with periwinkle for probably decades and encroaching into natural areas, right? So obviously this push, like, oh, it's a terrible spot to put it, swallowing up all the native species, pulling it out. That same plant in a little tiny boulevard in downtown Toronto might be a nice, tidy plant, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I know that's, you know, we're not all in the situation to understand plants at that level to see where they're appropriate or not, but I think that's where the education part comes in with us, is just opening up those discussions, and whether that's through people coming here and seeing things, you know, putting out videos or going to talks or conferences, or just, you know, having these discussions, right, where we're actually interacting with people and kind of having the conversation move forward. Because a few decades ago, we didn't even know it was an issue.
Yeah.
Like, we didn't actually know the hybrids were as prolific as they are, and then what you do with that. I mean, I'm not going to pretend we know the answers to that, but it's just, oh, this is a thing we should be paying attention to. And and just the same with garlic mustard, and it's an aggressive plant, but boy, we didn't actually know that it's changing the soil chemistry completely and preventing native species regeneration. So so I think that's the role we try to play the best we can. I mean, staying humble, we're 400 acres, which is a pretty big space in the city of Guelph, but pretty tiny as far as the world goes. So creating that green space with, you know, a lot of that kind of historical collection development. We've got plants from around the world, but I think as the decades have moved forward, we're really trying to be more thoughtful with native plants, as much genetic diversity with native plants as possible. Kind of putting those at the top of the list, as far as like what you see a label on, and not the showiest, fanciest cultivars and things like that. And then, you know, we're sitting in the middle of the arboretum right now, almost literally here. I know your listeners won't see that, but this space 50 years ago was completely cleared, completely. So, you know, part of that is with planting all the trees, but also really trying to do some of the restoration work. It's, again, humble on a small scale, but reintroducing plants from the watershed, from local seed sources, back into our corridors, and as those plants mature, we're adding understory species back in. It's a small thing, but I think that's the kind of thing we always talk about, those little small things that we can all try to do every day and at least expose people to things and say, hey, that's kind of a neat plant, what are you doing here?
Kind
of thing. So
I feel like every time I scroll through the Instagram feed or look at, get an email list from like Ontario Nature or something like that, it's more and more development. And more and more like laws to support the development. So it's always a challenge, and it's always nice to know that, you know, there are organizations like the Arboretum and Ontario Nature that are working and promoting conservation and maybe more appropriate land use.
Mm-hmm.
So
it's a continued pressure year after year, and it accelerates, right? So so
when these seedlings that y'all are growing out, as they grow, where will they go? Are they going to go back to the partners, back to the conservation authorities? Do they go to other arboretums? Do they go to private landowners?
Yeah, I mean, initially right now, we are the goal is really to have some planted here from as many individuals as possible to really represent that genetic diversity in Ontario as best we can. So sort of tying into that Rare Woody Plants of Ontario program, And they just require some extra steps, because with you know, cucumber trees, we're visiting the trees and collecting the seed, and with these ones, it's not quite as simple. Yeah. So some extra stages, but that's the initial goal. And then obviously, you know, if success rate is really high with initial propagation, then yeah, you know, make sure our partners have some that they can also back up some of their own parents in their own watershed. Beyond that, though, I mean, we get so many questions, you know, even pre us doing this work is, you know, do you sell pure red mulberries? And I think it's a really hard thing to get a pure red mulberry in Ontario, because I think even with best of intentions, someone collecting from what they think is a pure red mulberry tree, or even maybe they've had DNA tested as a pure red mulberry tree, we're finding you're still going to get hybrid offspring, right? Mm-hmm. So I think our hope would be that we could get to a point where we are... you know, reproducing some of the trees here on site, but also, again, we're not selecting them for kind of human, you know, specific ornamental or kind of cultural traits, but actually just making sure we're representing as much of that diversity as possible. And then if it goes really well, I guess we say we cross that bridge when the time comes, but we can actually see like what the best use of those trees is, right? Because even right now, our partners are kind of looking at the thought of, do we clear out all the white mulberries and try to keep planting as many of the pure red mulberries as possible? But then it's like, well, do we only plant the ones from our site, or should we introduce some from, mm-hmm. you know, our neighbors down in Hamilton or Niagara? And those are those things. I mean, we don't really know the best answers. I mean, we want to be careful not to like just create these genetic bottlenecks where we're just putting all these siblings beside each other, millions of them, right? So those are those active discussions we're actually having right now. And I think what we are making sure we're not doing is just kind of saying, this is what we're doing, we're going to make a million of them, send them out everywhere, and pat ourselves on the back and say we've done something well, because it's a much more complex issue than that. So, but we would hope that some of those people that ask us for a pure red mulberry because they love native plants and they really want one in their backyard would have a chance to get one someday. And that would be something that would be really fulfilling to us. And it's just with trees, it's always a longer process to get to that point.
You got to keep 5 aside for auction.
Okay.
And sure. Use the money to raise money for the project.
There you go. Yes. Okay. Sounds good. So.
Is there anything else that you're thinking of, or ways that people can ask questions?
Oh, sure. Well, I guess I'd first of all say thanks, Byron. These are like fantastic discussions. Love it. And I'd say when you came in the room, I thought, oh, there's a million things we could probably talk about all day.
Yeah.
so it's fun to be able to talk about these things. And I think with regards to red mulberry, certainly, and really all of the rare species programs here at the Arboretum, you know, we've been focusing on what we call ex situ conservation here. So that's something we can kind of manage, you know, ensuring we have some backups here in a hopefully very safe green spot for many, you know, decades or centuries to come. But ultimately, you know, no conservation program works unless the species can do it on their own in nature as part of the ecological community. So it really is important, I think, in our day-to-day for us to appreciate all of those green spaces we have around us, conservation areas and provincial parks and obviously fighting to protect the ecological integrity of those places as best we can, and also doing it on the small scale in our own little patches, right? Because it you know, what we said about the mulberries being so fragmented, we have so many rare species in Ontario that are being protected in these little fragmented parcels, and there's no connections being made. So, I mean, Henry always used to say, like, it's like green fingers going out in the landscape, like even small little thin corridors through urban areas that can connect birds and insects and seed dispersers and pollinators. And I learned flying squirrels are actually, you know, big spreaders of mycorrhizal fungus. So things like that, that, you know, we don't even, you know, it's just tip the iceberg what we even understand, right? So it's just finding ways to kind of create that abundant, diverse, resilient ecological community, and red mulberries are a small part of that, but an important part of it. So
yeah, they are a part.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much, Sean.
Yes.
I just want to say I've learned so much from you over the years. This is great. Every time I have a question to come to you, like I remember coming with the black cherry goo gamosis thing, and we looked that up. Hybridization between the high bush cranberries, asking about that.
Well, thank you. As I said, I've you know, when we encounter each other too, I always love the conversations, and I hope we can have some longer ones moving forward too. So.
Hey folks, we're back. Thanks for so much for listening to that show. Again, it's so nice when I get to follow up on the questions that I've had. And big thanks to Sean Fox for taking the time to put this, to do this interview with me. Thanks to Justine Richardson from the Arboretum for helping connect us again. And thanks to Mim. Yeah, you know what for. And I appreciate these conversations so much. I always learn so much, and it gets me to think about things in new ways. And that means so much to me. And I hope these shows do that for y'all. I hope that you can come up with questions and be like, hey, but what about, and hopefully these folks that I get to talk to or the research that I do that comes out in these shows can serve to answer some of those questions or inspire new curiosities for you. Yeah, if you want to learn more about the show, you can always go to www.toknowtheland.com. You can email me, toknowtheland@gmail.com. You can check it out on Instagram @toknowtheland. Yeah, and if you also want to support the show, that's always welcome. toknowtheland.com/donate. And there's a couple ways to help there. I think that's it. That's all. Take care.